Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is a mystery for many people, so I tried to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Justin Potts, who has lived in Japan for the last 15 years, working on various projects to connect different communities from rural to global with the power of Japanese traditional food culture. And he is also a Krabito, a sake brewery worker, and the co-host of Sake and Shochu Specialized Podcast, which is exciting, Sake on Air as well. So today we'll discuss how Justin got involved in Japanese culture, his fascinating activities to promote Japanese food culture and to empower different communities, his podcast about sake and shochu, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Now, let's start our conversation with Justin Potts. Hello, Justin. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
So, Jamie Graves, who came here a couple episodes ago, he very highly spoke of you. You're this amazing person and your incredible perfect Japanese skills and the knowledge of Japanese culture. So
yeah, I can't really vouch for any of that. I have no idea, but yeah, Jamie's a great gentleman. I just saw him yesterday.
Okay. So you're from Seattle, but you have lived in Japan now for 15 years. So, and your resume says you helped to develop new city to rural to international projects centered around food, agriculture, travel community, and value creation around the traditional food and culture. So we have so much to talk about today. But first of all, where are you from? And you're from Seattle, but why did you go to Japan in the first place?
Yeah, so originally, I grew up just outside of Seattle, and I went to university at Washington State University over in Eastern Washington, over by Idaho over there. And at the time, honestly, I had no particular interest or reason to go to Japan, but I kind of caught the travel bug. And I just wanted to travel. Mm. That was it. And I wanted to study abroad. And pretty much anywhere was okay. But I was really, really late in applying. And I went and said, I want to go somewhere. And they told me, Justin, you're too late. You can't go anywhere. I said, come on, there's got to be someplace. They said, we might be able to send you to this place in Osaka. I said, Osaka, I think I've heard of it. I'll take it. Sign me up. And that was it. And so I had about 4 months in Osaka. And I assumed I would never come back. I would be there for 3-4 months and I would come home and that would be the end of it. And 15 years later and a bit of back and forth and my whole life kind of ended up there. That's the short version.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds familiar. This is like me spending a couple months in New York, but this doesn't happen. So, wow. So, well, thank you for late application.
Yeah.
And, Japan got this huge benefit out of it. So, and I heard also heard that you had some digestive issues and Japanese culture helped you.
Yeah. Unexpectedly. That was sort of an interesting discovery in my spending time in Japan. And so growing up from about elementary school all the way through university, I just had a lot of sort of digestive intestinal problems and things like that. And I would be hospitalized pretty much once a year for something. And every time they'd run all kinds of tests and all these things on me and nobody could really tell me what it was. I mean, it was just incredibly painful and just really, really terrible. And I had kind of come to terms with, well, this is something I'm just going to have to live with or deal with. But then as a result of that, and sort of in my early mid-20s, I started using my body as sort of my own test subject under different types of, putting it under stress tests of different types of diets and things like that. And nothing really clicked. And I went extreme vegan. I went, you know, meat protein heavy diets. I tried just all kinds of different things. But then going to Japan and spending 3-4 months and just committing myself to eating quote unquote Japanese food, for lack of a word, in loose terms, I realized I just felt a heck of a lot better. And I didn't know why, but I was feeling just generally a whole lot better day in and day out. And I said, gosh, there's got to be something to this. And so that was sort of the first step into sort of generating interest in sort of what is it in this Japanese food and Japanese cuisine that might be.
Yeah, I'm sure that a lot of listeners are like, what is it? What's the thing at the core of it's a secret magic? Yeah.
And honestly, I don't know what it is. I haven't gone in and gotten the actual numbers or done the tested my body under, you know, on any sort of scientific level or anything. But the one thing that I started realizing, or I started feeling exceptionally better, was when I started spending more time in rural parts of Japan, spending more time with farmers, and getting more acquainted with a lot of fermented foods, miso, soy sauce, vinegars, koji and koji related products and things of that nature, and those things just became more integrated into my diet naturally. And that was at that point when that started becoming more part of my life, I realized I started feeling exceptionally better. So I was going, wow. I can't prove that this is, you know, the root cause or anything, but that is one discovery that has sort of resonated with me.
So that your microbiome converted in 3 months. This kind of sounds like a right time frame, right? 3 months, people say.
Yeah, I think so. Originally when I was first in Japan, I was in Osaka and around Kansai. I was traveling and I was young. I was a college student, so I can't say I was eating proper food by any means. So the term Japanese cuisine or Japanese food is in very loose terms. You know, all you can eat yakiniku and things like that were on the list, you know.
There's a BQ gourmet. Like,
yeah, exactly.
There can be junky stuff too. Exactly. Something very pure, purified version. And also I think rice is gluten-free, which may be a big part of it.
It is. That could be a part of it. And I've sort of explored that a little bit and experimented a bit with taking gluten in and out of my diet. And it's tough because some things seem to aggravate me more than others, while at the same time, sometimes I have no problem whatsoever. So I don't think that's it necessarily. Mm. But I'm all for rice. Rice and I, we get along pretty well. So,
So this should be maybe you can just another episode all about your diet.
Yeah, we can do that another day. I can do a blog post or something.
What just happened? We've been just talking about a lot of koji stuff lately, and I really think it's a big part of the health effects on Japanese people living the longest, the second longest in the world. So.
Absolutely. I think, and that was kind of one of the things that really got me into food and wanted to dedicate my time and my energy to the fermentation food culture in Japan. Right. And things. That was not just the discovery of fermented foods, but koji related mm-hmm. things specifically. Mm-hmm. It's because when I was going around and visiting all these producers of just amazing, amazing products that are, of course, delicious and taste wonderful, but also, there's when you taste something that resonates with your body in a very real positive way, it's not just something on the palate, it's something where, you know, you can tell from the inside. It really resonates. You go, wow, this is putting me in a good place. There's something really proper about this. And when I started, you know, digging into that, going, what is the through line with all these things? And yes, it was fermentation, but it was also koji. And in looking at it, it was like, why is nobody talking about this? Where is this? It was kind of before, about 10 years ago or so, there was kind of a big shio koji and kind of amazake, you know, explosion in Japan, where you started seeing more awareness around some of those things. But even at the time, even in Japanese, you could hop on Google and search, and you just couldn't find a lot of good information. I was like, how is it that everybody has, you know, you know, miso and soy sauce and all these things in their cabinet, you know, in their, you know, and even, you know, overseas, you know, a lot of people have them, whether or not they use them or fully understand them is, you know, a different conversation, but they're there. That's, you know, it's something that people have familiarity with. Right. And koji is tied to all these things. And how is it that nobody's even talking about this?
Well, that's the thing. Like, if you take it for granted, you don't even question.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just, that's exactly my case. And I keep hearing, like, how do you make sake? And I was explaining koji, like, what is it? So, yeah. And, you know, well, I was going to ask you this question at the end, but do you have koji workshops that you got organized, right?
So that's something where I'm kind of working on right now, putting together. I've done some of that. I do a little bit of that here and there, just in relation to sort of sake and fermented foods and things like that. And so I do koji-related things occasionally. I'm working on putting something together called Koji Academia, together with a friend of mine. His name is Nakaji. And he was a brewer at a place called Terada Honke out in Chiba, which they're kind of like the, I don't know, for people into wine, they're kind of like the Radicon of like the sake world, with, you know, regards to natural processes and things like that. And he was there for about 9 years or so. And then he is a big koji instructor. He's very focused on giving people the know-how and the skills to integrate it into their lives, to be able to use it and work with it. And so we're working on putting kind of a program together that is educational as well as entertaining, and then also providing koji specific or koji centric programs and tours kind of seasonally for people that are interested, that are regionally based, that are sort of integrated into the local regions, so that people, when they come out, they can.
So the, if I wanted to participate, is for the public, it can be anybody?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we're still kind of putting the pieces together. There's a website up that's incredibly vague with pretty pictures, but yeah, you can send us a if you look on the Koji Academia with a K, and you can if you just Google that, you can write on the contact form, and it will reach us, and we can let you know what's going on.
But I happen to get Koji spores in a package. I'm afraid to even open it because I don't know what to do with it. Maybe I will ask you.
absolutely. And then pretty soon there will be some videos and stuff coming. We're kind of working on putting that together. We originally were wanting to do a big sort of kind of an online school type of a program, which is what Nakaji, who I'm working with, what he already does in Japan. He has an online school there for Japanese, and hundreds of members and people that are taking part in that. But so then we're trying to figure out how we can translate that to an international audience. So,
okay. Well, there's a demand. I know that.
I think so.
Right. So Nanakaji-san actually is trying to re-educate or re-inspire Japanese people to learn about koji?
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And he worked in sake for a long time, but he works with koji of all types and varieties and making miso and creating koji at home for specific purposes. So giving people the know-how and the confidence to be able to work with it and make the things that they want to make that are useful and meaningful for them. And so kind of taking all that scary stuff, you know, you know, they say, I have this packet of spores and I don't know, you know, what's going to happen if I open this, you know, it's not scary stuff. So how do we make that approachable? And then irrespective of where it is you live, what sort of tools can you use? And then for people who are having trouble, you know, doing it at home, sort of being able to assist with troubleshooting and things like that.
Right.
And so, yeah, so he's been doing that in Japan quite a bit, and we travel together and do some things. And so, yeah, we're trying to figure out what we can do, just the two of us,
wow.
at least for the time being, for the international market
right.
and people who are interested in that.
Maybe you guys can come back together and talk about that.
That's what we're working on. So there's if all goes well, we'll be back this way in this autumn
really?
For something. So, yeah. Yeah. So
right.
if there's any interest, yeah, send us a message. We're happy to,
okay.
do some workshops or some fun
oh,
stuff.
Oh, let's
yeah.
discuss it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So the other thing you're doing is, of course, you are the Krabito.
Yeah.
But actually, before you get there, well, you went to college in Osaka and graduated. You started working, right? You did a lot of bunch of different things in the media.
Yeah, I did a lot of different things. I was working I worked in education for a while. I worked in like media localization, and a lot of it at that time it was like exporting stuff for the U.S. market. So it was a lot of like video games, anime, things of that nature.
Mm.
And then I worked in sort of PR marketing for a lot of like international IT companies trying to get into Japan, and just did a lot of different things before I got into food and food related.
So how did it happen?
So my now wife would be the short answer.
that's a good answer.
Yeah. as with most things, yeah, she kind of, yeah, inspired pretty much everything. And so her family ran a small udon shop and bento shop where she grew up in Kanagawa. But her dad is from Miyazaki. Her mother is from Aomori. So the two distant ends of the island. Yeah. And so when we started dating, and the things that she was cooking at home, she wasn't cooking, you know, the Japanese food that you'd go out and get at the local izakaya. It was stuff that, you know, her mom cooked or her dad cooked. And she grew up in the kitchen and working and doing all this.
Mm.
And all the things I was tasting were amazing. And like, why isn't this stuff on the menu? This is way better. I feel stupid going out and paying, you know, $20, $30 for meals in izakaya when this actually tastes a whole heck of a lot better. and so that was sort of the original impetus, I guess you could say, for my renewed interest in Japanese food. And then it also sort of worked out that, so her cousin is actually, he's a very visionary, talented gentleman by the name of Hima Furuta.
Mm.
And he does a lot of really amazing work in the realm of sort of what we're talking about and sort of developing new business together, in a lot of it around food and a lot around agriculture and connecting producers and the people with local resources together with the tools and the know-how in Tokyo as well as internationally. And so I ended up going to work for him.
Mm.
And he opened a restaurant, it was probably about 10 years ago, a place called Roppongi Noen, which translates to Roppongi Farm.
Mm.
And it was sort of one of the pioneering sort of farm-to-table restaurants in Tokyo.
Roppongi is really the metropolitan, the center of the whole...
Exactly. Area. Yeah. So, yeah, for those who don't have sort of the point of reference for that, it's farm and Roppongi do not go together when you try and put those
like
two things together.
Kind of.
Exactly. It's a complete oxymoron. You can't even imagine how these things could coexist, but there was like a little like greenhouse out there and these things, and we would bring not just farmers, but sake brewers or fishermen and all these people who were using their food in the menu to the restaurant, and they would stand up and talk and present their food, their ingredients, and we would do one day menus together with the chef. And so all of a sudden, as I was working for him and his company, doing a lot of sort of planning and development work and project work and education, I was also waiting tables at the restaurant in the evenings and all these things. And so I was having to learn about all of these ingredients and all these. And so I was meeting all the farmers and all of the producers. And I was in the position all of a sudden where I had to communicate what makes this food or these ingredients or these things special.
Right. Well, but the Hima-san, he was motivated initially by... Maybe he had a contact with great farmers or just...
Yeah, well, so he grew up and he was born in Roppongi as well too, which is again
wow.
not very common. So yeah, his whole world was Tokyo, was, you know, Roppongi and these things. And so he started to get very much inspired in doing that. He was very much inspired by those regional areas and the people out there. And so there were so many things happening internationally or starting to happen internationally around food and sort of food awareness and things that just hadn't quite picked up in Japan yet or weren't in a very in a place or in a space that was interesting and entertaining and easily digestible. And so, Roppongi No One sort of became sort of a physical space that was sort of an extension of the other work that he was already doing. And so, yeah, when I was in there working with him on a lot of those projects, I was waiting tables and I was having to learn from all these, you know, producers about what they're making and how that's tied to the region, all these things. And it's a given that I didn't know about those things. I'm this, young, you know, blonde white guy running around, you know, in this restaurant having to talk about why is this, you know, crab from Fukui so special, or why is this, you know, or whatever, why is this squid from this place so wonderful? And I realized that, and this sounds weird saying it, but that a lot of Japanese people didn't know anything about the food they were eating. When I was in the position of having to share and communicate that, and everything I was bringing, it was like, wow, I've never seen this, or wow, I've never had this. Oh, I've heard of this, but I didn't know what this was. It's like, wow, all this stuff that is just absolutely amazing and delicious and makes me feel wonderful is completely lost on a lot of the population here. And that was a population that was coming to a place like Roppongi to come and dine and spend money to do that. And it was, there's so many things to be done. And so it was kind of, I was feeling that every single day. It was very, very apparent. And so the number of things that could be done or should be done, all of a sudden you just start seeing all these things. And so that was sort of that's what kind of really then got me into it.
That's interesting you say that, because I think majority of the modern population in the Western world, including East Asian and Japan, but it's like developed countries, supermarket is the only entrance to food.
Yep.
And then you don't touch anything other than packaged ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and also, Japan is highly regional.
It is. It's very regional. But even if you go and visit now, you don't notice that if you just go and you just get off a local train. Whether you got off the train at Niigata or Fukuoka or Nagoya, if you just stepped off the train and looked around, they all look the same. You know, if just in and around the station. So if it's just a casual visitor, you're not going to encounter that. You have to take that extra step. You have to have some means of having somebody to be able to introduce you to what's really available out there. And that just really wasn't integrated and hasn't been integrated into the type of travel and experiences and exploration that sort of the Japanese tourism market and things like that catered to. And so there's just all this stuff that was just being lost on so many people. And so
It's interesting. So I happened to go to sushi dinner by the chef Watanabe-san from Teru Sushi.
Okay.
And he had some dinner here, and akauni, like red sea urchin.
Yeah,
I never tasted it.
Yeah,
it's like so smooth and slick, and it's so dense.
Yeah,
and you don't need to, you know, use any chemicals to treat it because it's less liquidy.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, how did I not taste this one? Yeah, it's like those are things really hidden in Japanese food culture. And that's the beauty of visiting local areas.
And a lot of people ask me, you know, are you going to go back to the States? Or do you have plans to go home or go anywhere else? I'm not against going anywhere else. I'm completely open to it. But like I said, there's so many things left to be discovered and to be shared. And so every day I learn something new. Every day, everywhere I'm going, somebody is showing me something or opening my eyes to something that I never would have encountered or would never had the opportunity to see or experience or learn about. And so just the stimuli in that sort of environment is just so fantastic. And so if I could get that somewhere else, I'm open to it. But gosh, it's not too bad out there.
Right, too busy discovering every day.
Yeah.
But you know, all those inputs that you have, probably I would say top 5% of the whole people living in Japan, you probably know more than anybody else. And how do you know, you've done a lot of things. We're going to discuss more about those things, but what's your intention to express? Do you want to write a book or do videos? Or like, you know, how do you try to connect communities, right? Yeah. So what's your medium to do that?
So I always kick myself for not having started a blog like 15 years ago. Because if I had been more on the ball and done it back then, I probably would have had a pretty nice platform of, you know, information that would be very helpful to probably a lot of people, but sadly I didn't do that.
That's in your head, though.
Yeah, it's in there. It's in there somewhere. I mean, with regards, so I did some video series and things in the past. I'm looking into writing some books. I've had some offers for things in mm-hmm. that area. That's not the focus of my work. I'm more interested in helping sort of develop the projects and putting together, how can I put the people who are making incredible things together with the people who can help them communicate the value and the nature and what makes that so special, and so that it can reach the people that really need it and that are really looking for it. And right. So it'll turn into sort of a long conversation, I guess, but it's, yeah, I mean, up until, especially over the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, has been in a lot of sort of work connecting people who are working in local food and local agriculture, local tourism, a lot of it around food and local gastronomy, together with networks of people in Tokyo who have the skill sets and the know-how, whether it be marketing or IT or finance or these other things, that have the passion and the energy and the resources to go and invest in a rural community that they can be a part of. And so one of the, if I get into it real deep, it'll turn into a long conversation, but it's called a project called the Morning University of Marunouchi.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that.
And that's essentially what that was. So for those who don't know, Marunouchi is kind of like the Wall Street area of Tokyo, I guess. Nobody lives there. There are no residents there. Mm-hmm. But you have some of the most, you know, just intelligent, dedicated, you know, passionate people who are very hardworking and have lots of resources to make a whole lot happen. So you have, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people all congregating in this area right around Tokyo Station every single day. But they're not communicating with one another, and that seemed like a wasted opportunity. So then together with Mitsubishi Real Estate, they wanted to help sort of figure out how to develop new value in that area and bring those human resources together.
Okay.
Exactly. And so we started using, in the morning hours before anything was open and running, started using cafes and showrooms and, you know, office buildings that are, you know, offices that weren't being used during those times, and basically turned the entire area into a campus. And then a lot of the programs and classes that were a part of that were centered around sort of rural development and travel and food and agriculture and things like that. So it was, there were these long-term programs where we were bringing together people from specific regions together with groups of 30, 40 individuals that all had an interest or a passion in learning more about that region or that specific topic. And who wanted to invest their time and energy in that. So you get 40 people with, and these are the type of people who would wake up and be to get to Tokyo at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, before going to work.
Well, maybe you can avoid that rush hour too.
And that was the initial things, right? That's what everybody wants to avoid. So that was the initial sort of, that was a big plus there, but it was, and yeah, it just ended up being incredible because you would get these amazing, just talented, passionate groups of people together that over a period of 3 or 4 months would travel back and forth to these different regions and learn more about the people and what they're doing and working on. And then even when those classes were over, they would come up with projects and ideas that would then continue for years and years and years. And they would just gradually build up these communities. Nice. And so it was, yeah, that was a...
Yeah, and I saw on the website, it started in 2009 in Tenzin. Now it's still going strong, and already I think 18,000 people graduated. and keep going still, like new program. The programs are really interesting too, from arts to, of course, like, you know, like local community products, everything. Yeah. So it's beyond. It's almost the opposite of what you're exposed to during the Marunouchi area during the day.
Exactly, exactly, and that contrast is really. Was what really I think drew a lot of people to it, and it was really those people that are, you know, in their 30s and 40s and 50s now that have been, you've been working, they've sort of developed some of them, developed their career, and they want to invest more in something else. They want another community outside of, you know, work and these other places. And so it was just a really, and when you have a class like you know, rural food development Niigata or something like that, the people who gather together around that specific topic. It's just an amazing, just fascinating group of people. And so just, yeah, a lot of really neat things happen. So
you as a person, you're part of the organizers. It's a group who's really coordinate the programs.
And yeah, and so yeah, so the company that I worked for, it's called Umadi. It was that I worked for before that I worked with Hima. Mm. And so that was, they were the original designers and producers for that, for that project. And so we were, as far as planning and operation, developing programs and, planning and organizing all that stuff. And so, I was in there, organizing different programs and setting that up and all that fun stuff.
Right. So, that's exciting. You're still involved?
Not so much right now. Mm-hmm. I sort of escaped the city. as much as Tokyo is a wonderful place, I spent so much time in so many places that were not Tokyo. And every time I was coming home to Tokyo, I kept asking myself, why am I coming back here? I mean, Tokyo's great, but it was, the countryside just had a whole lot more to offer as far as just sort of what I was looking for. It was just a lot more fulfilling. And so about, close to 4 years ago now, we sort of escaped out to the peninsula,
right,
just east of Tokyo, out in Chiba. Yeah.
But Chiba is fairly close, right? It's like an hour.
Yeah. For better or for worse, I can be in Tokyo in 60 minutes. Mm. You know, I can be in Marunouchi in about 60 minutes if I have to.
Right.
For better or for worse.
Right.
But yeah, where we're at, it's all beaches and rice fields. So.
Right. And you're a friend of Everett.
Yeah.
Brown.
Yeah.
Who came on the show and talked about his activities.
Oh, he did. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. I worked with Everett on a number of things. Mm. Yeah.
So, but he also does agri-tourism.
Yep. Yeah.
To promote local Japanese culture.
Yep. Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. They have a wonderful place. It's called Brown's Field out there in Chiba where agritourism and just, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. If anybody has a chance to go out there, I highly recommend it.
Artist.
And he's a photographer. Successful. He does fantastic, fantastic work. So you can look Everett Brown up too if you're looking for some amazing photos of Japan.
Chiba is a cool place.
Chiba's great. Chiba's great. Again, for better or worse, it's close to Tokyo, but it's the nice thing is that because there are so many people that over the last probably 15, 20 years have sort of made the shift out there who don't have to be in Tokyo every single day.
Mm. Well, let's take a quick break here then. So when we come back, we'll talk about Justin's Gravito experience and Sake on Air. That's a special themed podcast. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katema, and my guest today is Justin Potts, who has lived in Japan for the last 15 years, working on various projects to connect different communities from rural to global with the power of Japanese traditional food culture. So let's talk about your experiences at Gravito.
Okay.
Right. So you have worked many years in season at the Kadoizumi Sake Brewery in Chiba.
Kadoizumi for about 3 seasons.
Okay.
Is also not a super long time, but about 3 full-on seasons. Yeah, living in and doing that.
And is it related to another Koji inspired thing? Was it which came first?
So Koji was sort of the thing that inspired me originally, and then sort of examining what is the best means to communicate not just Koji, but the fermented foods and sort of all the things I was experiencing.
Mm.
Sake kind of became, I was like, this is the ultimate tool for creating enjoyable, diverse experiences and sharing that with people. So of course, yes, it's delicious. It's wonderful. I like it, but it's, together with sake. You can integrate it into so many different things. And there were so many things that just weren't be done in the world of sake. Mm. If you look at other beverages and spirits and things like that, the different types of collaborations and events and, you know, promotions and all the different things that people are doing, just none of it is happening in the world of sake. And there's so much diversity out there in it that just wasn't, that people just didn't know about and people didn't have the opportunity to experience. And so, I had the chance to, I was lucky enough to meet several producers who were making sake that was not only incredible, but was sort of in line with sort of philosophies that weren't necessarily the ones that were coming to the forefront. And they were making really incredible, delicious sake that just didn't fit within the paradigm of what a lot of the education and things like that were. And for me, it was a lot of the sake that wasn't quote unquote typical, for lack of a better word, was the type of stuff that would really resonate with the international audience. And Kido Izumi being one of them. And when I was trying stuff, I was like, why? There's just so many missed opportunities. I just wanted to get more involved in sake and started going out and visiting a lot more producers as sort of an extension of the work I was already doing. And the more I learned, the more I studied, the more people I talked to, I just kind of got to the point where I started spending a whole lot of time talking about sake and started realizing that there was only so much I could understand and communicate if I was only gathering information from people. And the best way to go about actually really being able to offer the type of information that not just consumers needed, but I think the brewers needed, was to actually go in and get my hands dirty and go and do that. And I spent about a year in Milan doing work around Japanese food and cuisine and Japanese food culture, doing, you know, cooking classes and helping organize cooking classes and events and a lot of sake events and things like that. And so I was talking about, it was back in 2015 when they had the expo going on there. We're working with a lot of restaurants and bars and things like that in the region.
That must be really fun.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. But I was doing sake events, at least two or three events pretty much every week for close to a year. And so after doing that for a year, it was just kind of like, I need to step back from talking about it. And I just got to go in and dive in. And so when I came back to Japan after that, it was just sort of, the timing was good, as if I was going to get out of Tokyo. It was a nice sort of cutoff point where it's, instead of returning to Tokyo, could go somewhere else. The other reason I wanted to get involved with sake production is especially a lot of the smaller producers that I was visiting and that were really inspiring to me. A lot of them, how should I say, they don't necessarily, they're not in a very healthy business state, I guess you could say. You've had a lot of sake people on the show. It's probably no secret to a lot of listeners that it's not the healthiest industry.
As the industry itself by nature is healthy, but the profitability.
Yeah, exactly.
Business concern is not ongoing business
exactly.
concern.
Yeah, and sort of the communication and sort of what needs to be done. And so a lot of these smaller producers, they just don't have the resources and the opportunities to go out and learn and understand about what could be done potentially. And so if I was going to go in and learn, work and make sake, I didn't want to just know how to make sake for the skill of knowing how to do it. I wanted to be in a position where I could be making sake, but also understand sort of the inner workings of the challenges that those breweries are facing on a business level, on an operational level, on a communication level. So what is it like to have to be, you know, in a team of four or five people making sake from, you know, 5, 6 a.m. until, you know, 6, 7 p.m. every day, 7 days a week. And then for, you know, 5, 6 months straight, and then having to also figure out, okay, how are we going to survive at the same time? How are we going to what product are we going to make? Who are we going to make it for? And all these things. And so it was easy for me from the outside, as an outsider for a long time, saying, hey, you should do this or you should do that. It's easy as an outsider to do that. Once you're on the inside and you actually have experience and you can sort of experience the challenges that those people are up against and sort of and all that. I wanted, by going on the inside, hopefully my goal was to then be able to say, be able to step back and say, you know, what if you were to do something like this or something like this or something like this, and then maybe we can make a product like this or do something like this for these people. Or what if you did something together with, you know, this other place locally, or what if we did something with these other restaurants here in the area, or, you know, to make those proposals is one thing, but then to also then be able to step back and say, I understand why that's challenging and I see how busy you are here and here and here, but then be able to offer proposals that are more concrete. Is it, so you are doing that now, but what if we were to shift it around so that, you know, we had somebody, you know, doing this at this time? And what if we didn't invest so much time and energy in doing this, and we had more, you know, you're able to make much more concrete
suggestions. Yeah, if you're too busy, you can't even think of reorganizing to make it because you're so occupied.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the small producers now, they're what they refer to as like Kuramoto Toji. And so they're responsible for the production of the sake, which means they're also responsible for the people and the management of the people and training and cultivating the people that are working there and making the sake. At the same time, they're responsible for running a small business that may have been going for 100, 200, 300 years, you know, that is in most cases not in the best state financially. And they've never been in the position of having to communicate their product and actually go out and sell their product. And so that is a whole lot to ask of any individual, and especially under the circumstances under which a lot of the brewing is happening. And so hopefully by getting in and getting involved, to be able to then be able to offer more useful proposals for the brewer that I was working with Kido Izumi, but then as well as with other brewers as well too. So that's why, so I work now with, I mean, I work freelance, I guess you could say, with a lot of different areas and a lot of different breweries. So Kido Izumi is sort of my local brewery, and that's where I was for several years. And so I still pop in and help out occasionally here and there.
Well, that's interesting, though, that it's such a traditional, like, it's known for natural fermentation. It's really established, in a way, traditional brewery to accept non-Japanese looking person.
Yeah, because
inside, I think you're more Japanese than everybody else, in a way. But so that's the thing, right? So because the industry is kind of... go ahead.
Drink water. I'm listening. Okay. I'm listening. I'm just sipping some delicious water here.
Yeah, so basically, your industry is declining. You need help. And the foreign market is the driving force of sake industry. So that's why someone like you are becoming like lifesaver in a way.
Oh, that's, I mean, how much help I've been able to be is, you know, I don't know. It's hard to it's hard to read that, but I mean, you know, a long time ago when it was, you know, Edo in Tokyo, you know, dictated very much the type of sake that was being made in other regions because that's where the population was, that's where the market was. Nowadays, the market is, it's not in Japan. I mean, it's still very much dictated by Tokyo right now because that's the only place you can get a real reasonable price for the, you know, for the level of quality product that's being made. But the next Edo is going to be, you know, it's going to be overseas because that's where the next market is. And so whether or not you have to make something to cater to that market, that's a whole nother, you know, conversation. And there's a lot of ways to look at that and think about that. But keeping that in mind is going to be, you know, crucial for, you know, essential for the survival of a lot of these, the breweries that are out there.
And I heard you also developed sake tourism programs in collaboration with Japan Sake and Shochu Brewers Association.
Yeah.
So that means that that's another opportunity for sake breweries to expand their financial support kind of cash flow in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a lot of, and so that's sort of why I try to keep myself outside of, I try to keep from being 100% sake because I don't think that the sake industry is in a position to solve all of its problems or to help it. So it has, you have to be able to have a hand in sort of other types of industry and networks and things like that. And so, and tourism is an amazing avenue for that because even though you're talking about sake and sake tourism, it's not just about sake. It's about the food. It's about the people. It's about the environment. It's about all the experiences that you can have. They can tie people to that. You're not going to get a whole lot of people to travel out to the middle of nowhere to have a glass of sake, but you can absolutely get people to make the trek out to the middle of nowhere to be in a beautiful place and meet wonderful people and have a fantastic experience for a day or two or these other things. That's the type of thing that you can get people really excited about. And sake and sake breweries can be a really, really powerful catalyst, I think, for that, as far as a tool for that. And it's easy to communicate. It's something that is universal. People can envision what a beautiful dinner in the countryside or a walk out in nature and a picnic somewhere in the foothills of the mountains with some sake or something. Mm. You know, the idea of gathering around food and beverage and these things, that's something that's universal and that people can get excited about. And so then how can you utilize the not just the sake, but the other local resources, whether it be food, whether it be nature, and other types of experiences that integrate sake. And so,
well, in fact, it's a part of the community, local community and the culture. It's just a piece of it. And you have the whole story through sake, but there are other chapters in the local community. Sake is a big one, but...
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And that's the other thing. I really ask me what I love about sake, and the nice thing is it's really kind of a microcosm of everything in Japan.
Yeah.
When you really start distilling it down, it connects to everything, and you can, you know, there you can draw lines and make parallels to just about all the things that people have an interest in, whether it's food or whether it's religion or Zen or these other different things. There's parallels, and there's a relationship to sake in some capacity somewhere. It can be integrated into anything, you know, or you can just take it to a dance party. That's cool too. You know, it can just be really simple, you know, it can run the spectrum from these really deep, you know, rich cultural experiences to just creating a good time, you know? And so it's very versatile like that.
Yeah. And I think the stories are very important to communicate. Yeah. And even if, you know, it's food is subjective, food items, whatever goes to your mouth, it's very subjective. But if you need a story to tell, because it's so beautiful and so inspiring, I think that's the value that you want to carry. And I think people appreciate it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's really so exciting and so rewarding is that to be able to be in a position to be working directly with the people who are making something as well as the people who are going to appreciate it most. Generally, with a lot of the work I'm doing, there's nothing in between. I'm generally the only person or the only, you know, entity in the middle of those things. So to be able to see firsthand day in and day out how what this person is creating is resonating with, you know, the people that are really looking for that is just, it just feels too good. You know?
Yeah, but you placed yourself in the lucky position, so it's amazing.
It just worked out.
And so let's step farther. That's the Sake on Air. That's an amazing podcast.
Thank you. Yeah. We're still figuring it out, but it's
Well, I'm a big fan, so let's talk about it. Okay. What is Sake on Air?
So Sake on Air is a biweekly podcast, and it is supported by the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association.
That's really the kind of integrative organization.
Yep. Yeah. The sort of a central agency that does a lot of the support for breweries and distilleries all around Japan. And basically, so it's something I've been talking about doing for a number of years, actually, because I just had been somebody who's taking in podcasts, especially while I was in Japan, just because I didn't have a lot of access to interesting conversations in English just in my day-to-day life. And so I was soaking up a lot of information, and I started looking at all the communities around different types of podcasts. And there was so many people who were so passionate about these really specific topics, and there was so much interesting, you know, conversation being generated around all these different shows. And I was, there's no reason there shouldn't be something about this on sake. And I started looking, there's endless, you know, shows on wine. There's endless shows on food and culinary, on beverage, of all these different things. There was nothing on sake, and that seemed like a shame. And so for a number of years, I was just telling everybody, I was like, I'm going to do a podcast on sake. Who's with me? And everybody was like, what, podcast? Because podcast isn't really a big thing in Japan. It's hard to... It's kind of a hard sell to a lot of Japanese, because they can't really envision what it is or what that format is and who's listening to it and through what channels.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because you can... do almost pretty much everything with your phone, smartphone, in Japan, but there's what is podcast?
It's so ancient. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the ones that are available there, they're just sort of like rehashed versions of Japanese radio and things like that. And so, and I was talking, there's a fellow who's done all kinds of amazing work to support us, Mr. Shuso Imada. He works for JSS, the Sake Makers Association.
So that's a studio, right? Location in Toranomon, in Tokyo.
So yeah, so they have a space. It's basically they just rebuilt it a couple of years ago. And so their offices are upstairs, but then in the first floor, they have a big, basically just a tasting room. And they gather, they cycle through different, you know, sake lists constantly. And there's always about 100 things on hand that you can just walk in any day of the week. Weekdays, and go in and try a whole lot of sakes for very, 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 very reasonable prices. And there's all kinds of information. If you have, you know, questions about wanting to go visit different places around Japan or learn more about sake or whatever, they can provide you with those information. So they already had that there. And so we just kind of did our own makeshift studio. We rounded up a whole bunch of equipment, and just started, after hours, just turning that into our studio space. And so, we're still kind of DIY a little bit at the moment. We're still figuring out the production stuff as we go. We're pretty much all sake people. We're not necessarily all radio people. So we're still kind of learning a bit as we go, but it's,
You are the, co-host.
Yeah.
And then, actually Christopher Piglini.
Yeah.
Shochu expert. Yeah. He came here.
Yeah.
He talked about this is shochu passion and everything.
Yeah.
So it's like you have a very strong staff host.
Yeah. And so one thing we really wanted to do is, I mean, there are so many wonderful, talented people doing amazing work in the world of sake all around the world, whether it be the US or Europe or Asia or wherever. And lots of fantastic sources of information and education are out there and available. But there's still hardly any information about what's happening in Japan. And there aren't a lot of channels that provide the context for that. And just in general, people's relationship with food and beverage and things like that. Now, people want to know why. I don't think you necessarily have to dumb things down so much, and you don't have to super simplify everything. You can trust people to be able to make decisions and judgments about things by providing them, you know, information and background and context. And so the idea was, so the people, you know, on the show together with John Gontner's the sake guy, Mr. Christopher Hughes, he's a WSET educator. We got a couple of gentleman Sebastian Demont, French gentleman who does amazing work in sake. We've got a couple of new hosts now. Rebecca Wilson Lai, she does incredible work with sake. She's been doing it for many years for movies. She's in a movie that's coming out, Kanpai 2 is coming out here pretty soon. Marie Nagata, she worked brewing in New Zealand for a while. We've got this amazing group of people who have access to pretty much everybody in Japan. And so we are in a position to get the information and answer the questions that people have. So as opposed to us being in a position of authority of here's the way it is, instead of saying sake is this, it's this, it's this, it's this, here's the definition for this and this, taking the time to sit down for an hour and say, so look, here's the way this is being presented. Here's what you commonly see. But you know what? This is out there too. This is out there too. There are exceptions to this and this. Why does that exist? And just sort of provide context.
Right.
And the idea is, how can we empower the people who are outside of Japan to get the information that they need that resonates with them or their clients or the people that they're, you know, educating to or serving to? So that when they are coming to Japan looking for new things or for new ideas, they can go, so I heard about this thing, you know.
And so, it's the actual trend that food's only that can be known only insiders who live in Japan.
Yeah.
It's plenty in each episode. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. I wish I knew that earlier, that kind of thing, every single episode.
Well, thank you.
I like sometimes you guys get a little nerdy, which
we,
I love.
We do occasionally. We do. So we try to keep it pretty digestible, but every now and then we kind of go down a bit of a rabbit hole.
Yeah, so it's for everybody, for beginners to like, if you really want to, it's like nitty gritty thing. Oh, you get it too.
Yeah, thank you.
But where can we listen to Sake on Air?
Yeah, so we're just rebuilding the website because when we got it started, it was kind of like, okay, we got to get this thing started. So it's pretty much just looks like a blog post from like the late 90s right now. So it's kind of embarrassing. But we're rebuilding the website right now. So you can look at Sake, just Google, if you just Google Sake on Air, it'll come up top. You can listen to it online. It's also on, you know, Stitcher, Spotify,
Apple
right. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and pretty much whatever. If you're listening to podcasts on something, it's probably on there.
I'm a subscriber.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really highly recommend. I think that's really precious, and I hope you're gonna keep doing a long time.
That's the plan. So, and ideally, we want to make it a resource for people because even the older content is still relevant to people, I feel like. You know, 100 episodes down the road, you know, episode 10, I think, is still going to be interesting and relevant. Hopefully it'll just be a pool, just a vast collection of information and resources for people who want to learn more and to have the context to be able to get help them get excited about sake or further their excitement about sake. And so, yeah, we've got a few plans in place. Like I said, we brought a couple more regular hosts on. We're sort of rebuilding the website. We're planning some events in Tokyo. And sort of some community-oriented funding things in the near future. So, yeah, if you want to keep an eye out, we should have some announcements here in the next, hopefully, month or so.
Okay, so listeners, it's Sake on Air. And so we discussed main activities that you worked on, but to summarize, what is a mission?
You know, to so my life is all in Japan now. And I'm in the very fortunate position to be able to have access to some of the arguably some of the best food and ingredients in the world, and the community of people who are creating that. The number of people who are making those things are diminishing rapidly. If those people go away, and that knowledge goes away, everyone is going to suffer. I mean, there's a lot to be lost. I mean, for those who don't know, the average age of a lot of farmers in Japan right now is like the early 70s. You know, I think it's way up there. You know, and a lot of the people who are making a lot of these traditional foods and things like that, it's a generation that is not going to be around a whole lot longer. And there is not, and taking that food and that knowledge and passing that on to the next generation, there is not a, there are not, at least currently in Japan, there aren't a lot of feasible platforms that can sustain people's livelihoods to be able to work and continue to do that. If we can't create that, I'm going to suffer. I'm not going to be able to, you know, and I have two, you know, daughters at home, and I want to be able to, you know, raise my children in an environment with the type of food that has given so much to me and my life and everybody around me. And it truly is possible that, you know, they're young now, but 10, 15 years from now, they just won't have access to those things. They just won't exist. And so, of course, for my children, but then for, you know, a lot of other families in this younger generation, that they will have the opportunity to be able to integrate that into their lives. Because if it goes away, it's hard to get it back.
I really appreciate your hard work.
We're just figuring it out every day as we go.
Well, that's a good sign, right? Because you keep discovering probably more than, you know, a majority of Japanese people. So, we rely on you. So
I'll do what I can.
Okay, so where can we find you, your updates online?
My updates. You can look on I said, I don't update all my social media all that often, but if you look, you know, Sake on Air, at Sake on Air on everything. My Instagram is Crew Jones, C-R-U underscore Jones underscore 33. If anybody gets the reference to that, I'll send you a prize. otherwise, yeah, Potts K Productions, P-O-T-T-S hyphen K, and then Productions is the small family business that I sort of run with my wife. There aren't a lot of updates there, but there's more information kind of about what we're doing and sort of the philosophy behind that. And then there's, you know, social media channels and stuff for that as well too. So yeah, if you poke around, we're out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments or, you know, what Justin is doing, you can just send us email and Japanese at heritageradionetwork.org or kikotem.com. And if you're interested in taking koji classes in Japan, yeah, that's available too. So, yeah. Right. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Justin.
Akiko, thank you so much.
Well, hopefully you'll come back.
I. Me too. Me too. It's been a long time since I've been in New York. I got to make this more frequent.
Yeah. So. Why not? All right. So listeners, Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Matt Patterson. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.